Welcome to Pop and Lock. I'm Landry Ayers. I don't know about you, but I am totally bugging because today we are going to party like it's 1995. Joining me today to discuss a movie we are all totally butt crazy in love with, Clueless, our editor-in-chief at Reason, Catherine Mangue Ward.
Howdy.
And the OG, my ride or die, we tried to bar the doors, but she barged her way in anyway. Deputy Managing Editor at Reason, Natalie Dowzicki.
I'm happy to be back.
There are movies that scream the 1990s, movies we've done on the show before. Hackers is one.
Oh my gosh,
but,
terrible.
But exactly. But they do so in a cringe way. But Clueless, to me, screams it in the most endearing, beloved, heartwarming, nostalgic way. It comes off as a real distillation of this era in a way that is fun and bright and bubbly. What makes this movie so 90s in a way that has staying power without being cringe-inducing?
So I asked us to talk about this movie on this podcast, and I want to kind of like set the stage for you because I think my answer has to include this information, which is that I went for like a ladies' weekend with a bunch of elder millennials or like Xennials, right? Like a very specific age band. We were born between like 1978 and 1982, right? There was a rainy day on this weekend, so we said, "What are we going to watch? Let's watch Clueless." And all of us were psychologically destroyed by this rewatch. Absolutely destroyed. What we realized is that like a huge amount of the things that we believed about the world as teenage girls derived directly from this movie. That this movie was like a portrait of our psyches in 1996. And that it was not, like your intro is interesting to me because it was not always a bright picture. There's actually a lot of the pathologies of the 90s and of 90s feminism are very much on display. And rewatching it, I think for the first time as an adult, it hit real different. So for me, actually, a lot of the takeaway was like, yes, iconic. Yes, like deeply, deeply embedded in my psyche and maybe an entire generation's psyche, but also like a fair amount of like poison in there, like some darkness as well.
Sure.
I think it's also different because I was watching it from a standpoint of like, wow, my high school was not like that, right? So like that's like it's like my high school experience is not like this.
You mean Philadelphia wasn't exactly like Southern California?
No. Also, like, I thought like a lot of parts that are iconic about the movie to me that like have staying power now is like the soundtrack, the costumes. Like that's one of the most popular, the yellow getup is one of the most popular like Halloween costumes like to this day.
100%. We cannot talk about this movie without like really just giving the yellow plaid two-piece ensemble its due because that thing gets reinvented like every 5 years, like it's always back. It's not just back now because we're having the 90s revival or whatever.
Yeah, that and flare jeans. But I do think the iconic parts of the movie that have like helped it like cement itself as like a movie that has staying power are definitely like the other aspects of it. I mean, some of the script is just really, I think, is cringy. Like the parts that like she'll make offhanded comments about how like coffee, she couldn't drink the coffee because it stunts her growth. Like it was like comments like that. You're like, what the heck? Like no one thinks this.
Well, I'm curious. I think it is cringe inducing. And that poison that Catherine mentioned, I think is really evident. And I would totally agree. I think it is aesthetically bright. It has, and obviously just based on the color palette and everything, it has that kind of vibrant, almost surreal quality to it. But I definitely agree. I can understand how there are these like amazing heights where it treats some of these characters in really creative and nuanced ways, while in others reverting to very odd, dated norms about gender and sexuality in general. So I think maybe that's a good place to start. with you two, especially Catherine, because you mentioned it. What were some of the things that leapt out at you that made you sort of second guess some of the concepts that you drew away from it, or sort of the norms or the mores of the time that now give you pause?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, it's an adaptation of Emma, right? And I'm a big Jane Austen fan, have definitely consumed, you know, reread Emma and consumed other adaptations of Emma in the meantime since I last saw Clueless. And I think, you know, the older you get as you're reading Emma, the more you realize that her kind of initial busybody, cheerful inclusiveness is in the end not a favor to the people around her, that it's like perfectly well-intentioned and that she's in many ways better than the other people in her social class who are just snobs. But she's still wrong. She's still wrong to try and make people, in this case, Ty, in the Clueless context, to try and make people something that they're not and to convince them to want something that they maybe can't have. And that is like a very, very interesting message in the year of our Lord 2022. Because that's still a very, you know, that's like actually still a really tough debate. Like, this is what our affirmative action debates are about in some ways. This is what our debates about worker retraining are about. This is what our debates about who should go to college are about. And in some way, I think all of us are Emma or Cher, like in the political class. Like, we're all trying to drag people who are not suited for a life that they don't want into a place where they find themselves wanting it and then suffer horribly for it. And there's a happy, spoiler alert, I guess, there's a happy ending, you know, for Ty in Clueless. But, you know, in real life, there isn't always a happy ending. And people really suffer from this particular kind of do-goodery, well-intentioned elitism that Cher/Emma displays. I don't think I understood that when I saw this movie initially. I was like, oh, it's a makeover sequence. Who doesn't love a makeover sequence, you know? And to this day, I will stand by the glorious power of the makeover sequence. But it's you know, it's a lesson about letting people be who they are, including letting people of different social classes be who they are. And I mean... even as I'm talking, I'm like, oh, I'm not sure I'm allowed to say this. And I think that's interesting, right? Like, this movie let itself say this partially unselfconsciously because the 90s wasn't so sensitive about these types of debates, but also because it's true to the source material. And that's what the source material leads us to.
Yeah, I also think that like a lot of the more like problematic lines, especially like reading it now, is like the role a woman plays in like her relationship with like a man. So like when you go through that whole sequence when Cher is waiting for I'm blanking on his name, to come over, and she's like getting her friend's like helping her do her makeup, and she has like powder, like red powder all over her face, and then she's like in the dialogue in the back, like in the narration that Cher is doing, she's like, and you always have to have something baking while you're, like, a man is over. And then like there's like the classic scene where she realizes whatever she's baking is burning. But that like, when I watched that, I've seen this movie like 800 times, but when I watched it more recently, I thought of like, wow, that just screams like 1950s housewife, which I don't think that was something that the 90s, I mean, yeah, I thought like the whole culture was completely different than that. So that was why that part was like a little bit confusing. And that was also like speaking to like, I feel like speaking to more of like the elitism aspect than anything else. Also because the parents in this movie, like the dad is like an absentee lawyer.
That kind of reminded me of like the 80s parent vibe of, you know, something that they sort of lampoon in Stranger Things, where it's like, because everyone is out and working all of the time, the parents are never there to like monitor these kind of latchkey kids who are always out and about doing their own thing. And even when they're older and they can have more freedom and stuff, that there's never the lack of authority in any context, both parental and within the school, that is just chaos, like you mentioned before, is clearly evident. But there's also this weird kind of it was at the time and is in the movie as well. There's this weird 1950s nostalgic quality, mostly aesthetic, but I mean, it might come through in some of those gender norms, sort of like seeping up from the bottom, but with like Christian, his character with his like his big high-waisted pants, and he's reading Burroughs, and he drives that old vintage car.
The classic exchange when they go out for the date, when Cher and Christian go out for the date, and he says, "Do you like Billie Holiday?" And Cher says, "I love him."
I also, a moment for Paul Rudd, that man never ages. Like, oh my God. It is absolutely wild. Crazy.
Yeah, I mean, that was, as I'm watching the movie with my gals, like that was the first and most, like all of us just like screaming. What do the kids say? Screaming, crying, throwing up, right? Like just like Paul Rudd appears on the screen and we're just like, what's happening? And, you know, there's, you know, I think that, you know, the movie really deserves props for like how well it handles source material that doesn't map neatly onto modern mores, right? Like she, in the end, Cher ends up with essentially her stepbrother. You know, similarly in Emma, like it's, you know, it's the man who was there all along who sort of shaped her as a person. That would have been like less problematic, I think, in Austin's time, but they actually sort of managed to handle it with a like complicated LA in the 90s style, like, you know, they're not really related and it's okay and, you know, whatever. You know, I think there's been some discourse around the age difference stuff these days. And she is meant to be very young. But she's also, as in Emma, meant to have assumed some of the roles of basically like the woman of the house, right? Her mother is dead. And her father is like well-intentioned, but as you say, like somewhat absentee. The absenteeism is not painted as a problem in this movie because it wasn't perceived as a problem in 1995 or 1996. Like it was just like, yeah, your parents are busy. Like, I don't know. Where are they? Who knows? I will say on rewatch, the dad makes no mistakes. Real talk.
No, he's a great dad.
He is a great dad. And I did not know that when I watched it the first time. And this is actually, it's similar to the dad again in Emma, who comes through in the clutch, right? Like the key scene between Emma and her father. And also this recurs in Austin, right? Like this, there's also a key scene between Lizzie Bennett and her father where the fathers basically say, listen, I know the rules, but you should do what will make you happy, right? Like there's like some version of that speech in Austin that recurs, and the sort of father figure, but he actually does everything right. I mean, I guess you could quibble with the, one of the iconic lines about, when she gets her report card, and she says, well, some teachers were trying to lowball me, Daddy, and I know how you say never accept a first offer, so I figure these grades are just a jumping off point to start negotiations. Personally,
okay,
love
that,
it. Feel
you're
that
raising
that is
your child well if she can argue that way.
Yeah, like no notes, good parenting, but I recognize that some people might read that in a more declinist sense.
Oh, I'm sure a lot of people would disapprove of a lot of the with. I'm always curious, and I like to imagine the question and just the thought experiment of like, could you make this movie today? How would it be different? How would it be the same? And a character like Cher, I feel like it would be hard without some sort of adjustment for her to be as likable to audiences today because she is just so unapologetically upper class and it, you know, makes no apologies for the things that she has been born into. And in some sense, I think for people who don't really examine the movie, and it gets a lot of grief for this, is that people call her ditzy or something like that. And I think that isn't quite the term that I would use for it. I really think they do a good job of saying clueless or maybe naive, because Cher is very bright and smart and organized and works very hard. She is by no means the sort of lazy upper class, like super entitled person. While she might be half of some of those things, she does have a lot of really, really strong qualities and tries to act virtuously and has the best intentions. But she isn't necessarily just someone that we would sort of get on the screen now and a lot of people would scoff at and be like, oh, I can't empathize with a person like this at all. She has a kind of what you were talking about it earlier, Catherine, with this sort of trying to pull people into positions that they may not want to be in or be suited for. It has a kind of Leslie Knope attitude to it, where she's like, I have all of these great intentions and ideas, but not everybody wants to follow them. And in the end, I think even by the end of Parks and Rec, you see that both her town and the people that she's close friends with don't need to all work in government and sort of strive in the same ways that she wants to strive. Really, when they split up and each go their separate ways and pursue the things that they want to do, they all end up exponentially happier and more fulfilled.
Full disclosure, obviously I'm an Emma. Like, obviously I'm a Cher. Like, I'm absolutely exactly this character. So I have a lot of empathy for her of like, I really do think I know best for lots of people lots of the time. And like, one of the sources of my libertarianism is I know intellectually that that's wrong, right? Like, I have
there's
these,
an internal like, struggle.
I have these like authoritarian tendencies, which is why I am a libertarian. And I think, you know, those on the interpersonal level are just like a charming quirk, and on the political level are like a sinister, cause for all of our problems. But the, the impulse manifests itself also in extremely positive ways, like her fantastic debate class speech about immigration, which is just frankly like, again, you know, I think it's funny because the teachers are quite caricatured in this movie, right? They're exasperated by their ridiculous student bodies. They are not, however, angry or burnt out, right? Like, they're just kind of like bemused. And I think that is sort of interesting, but they are also absolutely not interested in doing what I think like 21st century teachers would do, which is like they would hear this speech that she gives and say like, yes, actually, that was great. Let me like nurture and feed what is special in you. They are just like, that was not the assignment. What the hell, man?
Yeah.
But the fact that she calls them Haitians is incredible. But it's a speech about immigration. And she says, she says, it's like when I had this garden party for my father's birthday, right? And I said RSVP because it was a sit-down dinner, but people that came like did not RSVP. So I was totally bugging. I had to haul ass to the kitchen, redistribute the food, squish in extra place settings. But at the end of the day, it was like the more the merrier. In conclusion, may I remind you, it does not say RSVP on the Statue of Liberty. Girl, yes. Yes. That's 100% yes.
What a cheers to that.
As a former high school speech and debate competitor, well, former high school and college speech and debate competitor, there was a part of me that was like,
Landry, I'm so surprised to learn.
I know, right? It's shocking when you meet me. There's a part of you that both, it like clenches every muscle in your body because you're like, you spoke for like 20 seconds. But then also you're like, but she was the most succinct. She had evidence. She had like claims and a bit of a warrant. Like I thought it very much, I felt conflicted.
Honestly,
but I also
good.
Was like, open borders queen. I support her.
Yes.
Also, the teacher's reaction was just like, are you kidding? But like, I kind of appreciated that. Like Catherine was saying, it was like the teachers, they're like a little bit like, well, we're stuck in this situation because we have this student body, and you know, this is how it's going to go from here on. And I think it's interesting. I saw Landry put this in the notes, but to me, the like when I think of like a movie set in like a high school drama, I think of Mean Girls because that was like the iconic high school like clicky drama movie when I was younger. And when you juxtapose that Mean Girls with this movie, they have like some similar like trends, but obviously the movies are very different. Like the whole trend of like trying to change someone to make them like they like when you know what's when you think you know what's best for them, like that's what they do to Lindsay Lohan's character in Mean Girls. Like they change her completely, and now Lindsay Lohan's character like buys into it and, you know, goes the whole on Wednesdays we wear pink. But I think those two movies kind of show a little bit like different sides of what was going on culturally at the time they were released. Like Mean Girls was in like 2005, I think.
2004.
And I think that was much more like they really leaned. Of course, Landry knows that date.
Well, I Googled it. I Googled it beforehand. I watched it on a plane to Disney World in the sixth grade. It was the first time I was on a plane. It's a core memory. Leave me alone.
It's a core memory. So I think, but that movie seemed like incredibly negative, right? Like, and the whole, I mean, it's called Mean Girls. So it's like all about Clicky, all about, you know, who thinks Regina George hurt them the most. And that movie has like a completely different vibe than Clueless. Like Clueless seems more like optimistic, even though there are like some cringy moments. Mean Girls, I never walked away from seeming like thinking that it was optimistic. And then when I was like thinking about more of like the high school movies I've seen that reminded me of Clueless, I also thought of Princess Diaries, which sounds weird, but like that's also like there was like that weird high school. There's lots of weird high school moments. They go to like a small private high school in somewhere in California because they're near the beach. But again, that has that same like vibe of trying to change someone to make them into like what you think is best for them. And like, I know I'm a Princess Diaries stan. That movie came out in 2001. Landry, you can check it.
And but it was like
take it to
quick.
The bank.
Let me take that.
Yeah. And but like checks again out. Like that's another interesting portrayal of like, you know, the high school scene. That I mean, that movie is also just like a little heartwarming because like every girl wanted to be a princess at that age, whatever. But I think when you like look at all those three movies at the same time and you juxtapose them with each other, Clueless definitely is like the most optimistic in the sense that like you don't see like in theory, Cher should be the mean girl, right? In every high school setting, Cher is the mean girl from like the movies of the early 2000s. But she's not. So they almost like flipped who you thought was going to be the mean girl in that sense.
Or she is. She actually does all the same things that the mean girls do in other movies that use this trope. But the movie is told from her perspective. And so we have this empathy for her, right? And I think, to me, the other film that's like, you know, if you're going to kind of put it on a spectrum is Legally Blonde, right? And so that's, you know,
classic.
But that one is like where the person being made over is making over herself, right? And so that there's like the sort of three different variants here of like the Mean Girls makeover, the Clueless makeover, and the Legally Blonde makeover, which hit different, again, on the kind of feminism spectrum, as well as on the, I don't know, just the kind of where they're sitting in their cultural moments. And I think, you know, the idea that there was discourse at the time around whether Alicia Silverstone was fat, right? Like that was a thing. Like looking at her in her like cute little unitard in this movie, it like breaks my heart that was a conversation. And yeah, they have her saying lines like, oh no, I had two mochaccinos this morning and I feel like a heifer. Like, they just, like, put those words in the mouths of 15 and 16-year-old girls who are watching this movie with no thought at all about, like, what – and I think it's because it didn't originate in that movie. That was just – it was just in the right culture. And this was – you know, this was the period where kind of heroin chic is coming in and there's, like, a very particular aesthetic, which, you know, Alicia Silverstone is in many ways the kind of, like, sunny California counterpart to that look. You know, she suffers later, I think, for that in her career. But it's also, there's just lots of casual, inter-lady, you know, inter-lady warfare. The line about someone being a Monet, and then Ty says, what's a Monet? And she says, it's like a painting, see? From far away, it's okay, but up close, it's a big old mess.
Ugh.
Ooh. What?
Rude.
What?
Whoa. Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird. Like the lineage that we're talking about of like other films that exist on this spectrum. Like I thought of Mean Girls also, Natalie, because at one point Paramount, what in the midst of like looking at all these films they owned, they wanted to release like CD-ROM games. And they were like, we're going to do Pretty in Pink, Clueless, and Mean Girls. And I saw the connection between the latter two, but the Pretty in Pink one was much more tenuous. And I was thinking of other things that exist within this network of movies and influences. And I can see how we get to Mean Girls from Clueless, but I think it takes, because especially because not only is it really similar, they crib it like exact moments and lines. Like we, like Catherine was saying, the perspective of Cher is what we take instead of Regina George in Mean Girls, where they do the makeover, and they try and make this girl into something that she, you know, isn't, and then that new girl takes the place of the one who did the makeover, which happens to Ty after she is almost thrown over the railing of a shopping mall, and everyone suddenly flocks to her and she becomes the center of attention for a brief moment in time. But the movies that sort of exist in the Clueless line are like Clueless and Legally Blonde, exactly. But how do we, what came in and intersected with those to make Mean Girls? And to me, it's Heathers and Jawbreaker, which are both really, really interesting, much, much more dark, sort of biting dark comedies about this idea of the high school girl and all of the tumult that goes on in her life. And then when those two films come together, we get the Mean Girls thing that wraps them up together and isn't quite as hard-edged, but is not nearly as sunny and encouraging by the end. But it still has that kind of like, everybody gets a little bit better at the end, even though Regina George gets hit by a bus.
I was just going to say, Regina George gets hit by a bus.
Little, yeah, but she gets better. She doesn't die.
Yeah. I mean, there's a certain, in keeping with the title, there's a certain like naivete in Clueless that I think, you know, again, this may just be me speaking to the person I was when I saw this movie the first time. But like I was an absolute sucker for all the like health class propaganda. Like I legit believed that if I did a drug, I would die. You know, I mean, and it's, you know, when we have Cher saying stuff like, you know, it's one thing to spark up a doobie and get laced at parties, but it's quite another to be fried all day. Like she really is bringing this kind of like Protestant work ethic to her like Los Angeles 90s teen social life. It was resonant. Like there's something there that's like this longing for the sort of pretense of a kind of, you know, the it's the baking bread thing that Natalie mentioned. Like, you know, there's a sort of like 1950s, like you work hard, you make good, you can be anything you want to be. All you need is to kind of like be culturally literate and follow the rules, right? And by the end of the movie, we have, you know, we have Ty saying to Cher, like, you're a virgin who can't drive. And it hits, it like cuts deep, right?
It does. It's so
cool. And it's like, she is a virgin. Like she, you know, in choosing this sort of weird blinkered 90s version of 50s virtue, she has overly circumscribed her life. And, you know, she wants to kind of take a woman who is in many ways more sophisticated, you know, who has seen more shit, and like draw her backwards into this kind of less broadly aware. And I think, you know, we should probably take a minute and talk about race in this movie, which is like both like the cringe levels are astronomical in the sense that like the black characters are, you know, given lines that are, you know, it's not like minstrelsy, but it is like, every line spoken by a black character is like written in this strange pastiche of like the way that actual black Americans spoke at that time and whatever Hollywood screenwriters thought black Americans sounded like, I guess. Like, I don't know. Maybe that is what people sounded like in LA, but my high school was 50% black. Like, people didn't sound like that. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, that was, that was definitely one of the more cringy parts, especially like watching it back more recently. Like, I didn't pick up on that kind of stuff when I watched it when I was younger, like this, because this is used to be me and my sister's like favorite movie. And like every time a black character talked, I was like cringing this time. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like so painfully like just like obvious still, that there's a disconnect between what Hollywood thought like the lexicon was and what it actually is like.
Well, and at the same time, it's like, I can't remember fully, but I mean, certainly at that time, people thought nothing of populating their movies exclusively with white characters. So on the other hand, it's like, okay, well, but at least, you know, at least they tried.
It was,
like, I don't
it was
know.
A step, a single step. Right.
Yeah.
Especially,
and I you have to give the movie credit for like, it passes the Bechdel test with the flyingest of colors, but it also passes like the characters whose experience is outside of that of our, you know, admittedly attractive white female main character, like they have their own lives. They have their own conversations. They interact about things that are not just our main character. Like, you do have to give it credit for that. Again, small credit. It's
right.
The
topics of discussions that pass the Bechdel test in and of themselves have their own issues that come across,
yeah.
Especially
yeah.
with that sort
that
of
is correct.
Intra-female discussion.
No, so my case for this movie is that it is the Hamlet of my generation. Like the number in that, wait for it, in that a lot of phrases that you think are just phrases in the English language are actually from this document, right? I mean, I think that this is like when you're in high school and you read Hamlet for the first time and you realize that just like stuff people say all the time is Shakespeare and that it's right there. It's in the text. It's clearly written for the first time in this text. And I think rewatching this movie made me realize how many of the phrases that I just casually kind of thought were like things people said in the 90s were in fact things, lines in Clueless that just got into our heads. I mean, the as if is like the most classic of the lines, but the like rolling with the homies, the totally bugging, the like there's just like so many turns of phrase and lines in this movie. I mean, and also like that when they're in the line for tennis and she says like, my doctor says I can't do anything where balls fly at my nose. And someone says like, well, there goes your social life. Like every line in this movie, when they open their mouths to say it, I was like, oh, I remember that line yeah. too.
And I was riding the crimson wave. I had to haul ass to the bathroom.
Yes. And I don't know if, I mean, I doubt that Clueless is the first movie to do the anthropologist's exploration of the lunchroom, right? Where it's like, there's
right.
the stoners oh, yeah. and there's the whatever.
Another
but
Mean
that
Girls
is a trope
that they took. Exactly.
In Mean Girls, in many other subsequent movies. I doubt that it was invented in Clueless, but it certainly reaches its like initial, like it reaches its peak form in Clueless. And that is 100% how I perceived my high school cafeteria. Like I could have given you the Clueless map. I could have given you the Mean Girls map of that cafeteria because that framework was given to me by this film. So I think it's for its all of its cringe, for all of its flaws, I do think that, you know, the number of things that it just incepted into the brains of like elder millennials is kind of actually astounding.
Well, I was thinking about this when I was rewatching it. Do you think the people that watch anyone younger than us that watches Clueless now, like we're all rewatching it because, you know, it had like, it's a core memory for Landry. Like it all had like pivotal moments in our lives. Like me and my sister loved watching it, but like the high school age and older kids that watch it now, well, one, are they even watching it? Like, is it something that's on their radar, or like, do they watch it now and laugh and are like, ha ha ha, mom, that's like how your high school was. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if it's cherished anymore.
I think it might be like Hamlet in that you watching it is irrelevant. Like you don't have to consume the original document.
Right.
Like we're living in the world that Clueless made, man. That's an overstatement. But like,
I mean, only slightly.
But the fact that, right, like I think many, many people who are in high school today would recognize the yellow plaid skirt that we started out with, right? And they might even be able to source it to one of those 90s movies, right? Like, I maybe they don't know it's Clueless, but maybe
they would go,
oh,
yeah, I've seen that gif or like,
yeah.
I know that meme, but they would have no idea its source. It's like totally divorced from the source.
But this is, I mean, I suppose this is like maybe too big a question to take on, but like, what is a better legacy? That like some list of movie nerds thinks that you made a great film, or that you incepted a bunch of stuff into the culture that lives beyond even the awareness of the movie.
Well, there's also, and there's a Broadway play now too, right? There's a Broadway play.
They did a musical. Although, yes.
I think like Broadway nostalgia musicals are, like, if anything, it's like, you know, when the New York Times does a trend piece, like if Broadway has made a nostalgia musical about it, like it's over for
sure. Yeah, the shark has clearly been jumped over.
Just leaping over the shark.
Well, they did that for Mean Girls and Legally Blonde.
They did it.
Actually.
Yep.
My point stands. Yeah. I feel like, thank you for the.
I will say the Mean Girls musical, not terrible. Legally Blonde, a big hit. I can't say I've listened to it too much, but I mean, people love it. They still love the musical, which I was not expecting. I was thinking people would scoff at it and be like, this is a cash grab. But no, people, they eat it up. They eat it up.
Can we talk about one last element in this movie, which is the centrality of the driving test, right? So this is a thing.
Okay. Yeah.
This is a thing that, like, I do think is like a huge cultural change, right? Like, if you're a teenager now watching this movie, I'm not sure that you understand the crushing. I mean, you know, I would say like you're a virgin that can't drive, like the crushing feeling of failing a driving test in the year 1995, like catastrophic, right? And now it's like, well, I mean, like a lot of kids don't even get their licenses, whatever. Like, and I wonder what that, I don't know what that says. Like, you know, always Natalie and I are joking about every story is a zoning story, if you look closely enough, or like a licensing story. And I do think there's probably like, you know, the peak of prosperity in this period that this film is set, and especially in Los Angeles during the period that this film is set, is this sprawly McMansion car culture. And a lot of our libertarian brethren at that time spent a lot of energy defending sprawl. Right. Like, this is a dream that people want to pursue. They want this. And, you know, to be told by environmentalists or certain types of urbanists or whatever that, like, this is you shouldn't want this. Right. It's the same as Cher saying, like, you shouldn't want the stoner skateboarder. Like, you want the wrong things and you're bad because of it. And I can fix you. You know, we're not in a moment right now where people want that life. Like, you know, the most elite people are living in high density downtowns and they want to Uber around and they, you know, they want their kids to take mass transit or whatever, I guess. But I think we might be returning to that, right? I mean, there's this sort of, urban decay meme that's going on now. You know, there's not, like, we never, other than the Pismo Beach disaster, which exists in the distant background of this film, we never see a person suffering, right? Like, except for love. But we know in the background, like, when she gets mugged at gunpoint in a parking lot, like, lest we forget, like, that was a thing that happened in the 90s that people were like, yeah, that just happens to people. Like, it's totally normal to sometimes get held up at gunpoint and have to ruin your Christian Serrano dress on the ground because you're face down in a parking lot in LA, you know? And it was like, it was a very different moment in terms of crime, but I think at least the perception is that we're returning to that. And so it would be interesting to me to see if this kind of siren song of the car-based suburban utopia, like, if that goes back to being the thing people want, is that going to reorient some of our cultural fights in public policy? You know, do we want to be Cher's dad, or is there something else?
There's also, it was funny because at least when I was in high school too, like, your driver's test was like, that was something everyone talked about, right? There was like a pivotal moment in high school, like when you could drive your friends around. It was also like, people would be like kind of quiet about when they were taking their test in the event that they failed so that they could like re-sign up and no one would know. Like, it wouldn't be like a huge embarrassment if they failed. And I don't think as many people, like me and my siblings, we like went for that driving test the day we could, right? And it was like, we signed up, we were there at like 9:30 a.m. in line at the DMV and like, it was, you know, all hunky-dory. I don't think kids do that anymore. Like, I don't think it's like, but it was also, I mean, my parents wanted to stop driving us to school. So, like, they had, like, other other motivations to like get us a driver's license as soon as possible. But like that and like the amount of people that just like don't own cars. But maybe, I mean, this is also like a little biased just because like we all, well, besides Landry, live like in cities that you don't really need a car. And
I don't need a car where I live. It's great.
but I think you're right, Natalie. Like this, the centrality of this rite of passage of getting the driver's license, and like that it was also a referendum on like, I mean, it was our bar mitzvah, right? Like it's like I'm an adult now, right? And it was like we were not adults. Like narrator, they were not adults. Like, but
when you have that agency and the ability to go outside the geographic bounds that you've never had access to before, it's a huge, huge. Like turning point in your life.
It was a freedom. It was like a freedom. Yeah.
And in fact, right, the scene where Dion accidentally goes on the freeway, and then you know there's like this panic, and they're driving on the freeway, and they're all gonna die, and the you know truck is honking, and then you'll recall in the movie that like that what happens is like then she loses her virginity, right? Like it's like an actual, it's like multiple rites of passage that are all based around automotive competency, and that's just gone. I think it's still actually a reality for much of the country, but the teenagers that I know and the sort of people who live in cities, it's much less central. And so I guess just among other things that age weirdly in this movie, the emotional drama around failing your driving test is like, well, just take it again. Who cares? No, everyone cares. It's the most important thing.
Yeah, I'm always curious. I always think it's probably not as big of a deal because access to resources and social media and socialization is just, the barriers are so much lower than they were when we were younger, because to see people and talk to people, it was either call on a landline. You know, I was at the age where younger and younger were starting to get cell phones. So there were plenty of people that still didn't have access to them at a certain point, while others were. And even just a few years before that, it was still, you know, very common for people to not have cell phones. So to go socialize with people and also to gain information, whether it's to go to the movies or go to the record store or anything like that, meant going somewhere else. And in a car dominated culture, there were only so many ways that you could do that. And today it's exponentially easier to, you know, log on to Spotify and listen to, you know, the entire, catalog history of the world, or watch something on one of the 50 million streaming services that we have, all while messaging people, you know, all at once and carrying out, you know, 15 different flirty text message threads with all of the different boys and girls that people are, you know, awkwardly, teenagerly flirting with. It's just, it's a completely different ball game. And one that is just so daunting and otherworldly compared to what Clueless exists in. So it's just a really interesting sort of time capsule of what the world was like at that period, even if it's not super real. There's enough in there that is real.
I'm always team, like when people say like this movie was revolutionary for its time, or like this movie really captures, it's a period piece, that makes me not want to see it. Like, I don't know. Sure. I'm just like a Philistine. I just don't, I mean, obviously I'm on this podcast talking about Clueless, right? Like I know y'all have done some highbrow stuff. And so I'm feeling a little self-conscious about bringing
We also talked about The Simpsons, so.
I love to make people watch terrible things. And everyone's be like, you want to do what movie? And I'm like, I want to put you through hell for this show.
But this is a delight and short.
This was a treat.
Oh, God. Mm. Remember when movies were short? It went down easy, but it was kind of nutritious in the end.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening. As always, the best way to keep in touch with us and get more Pop and Lock content is to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at the handle @PopandLockPod. That's pop, the letter N, lock with an E, like the philosopher, pod. Make sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time.